We are going to talk about the politics of healthcare during this hour. We will talk about the Senate's GOP healthcare bill, the Congressional Budget Office report on that bill, and whether this version is moving forward. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are going to talk with a political scientist, not only about the politics of the healthcare debate, but the policy that is involved here. What exactly would this Senate version of this healthcare bill do to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act? And we will welcome your questions and your views. Do you want this Senate version to move forward or not? Why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Senator Ron Johnson has been opposed to this GOP Senate bill. He held a telephone town hall last night. You can tell Senator Johnson what you think about this bill during this hour as well. Let's welcome our guest. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. His research, among other things, looks at the politics of health reform in the United States. He is the co-author of the 2016 book, Obamacare Wars: Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. Well, first off, let's talk about the Congressional Budget Office releasing its report on the Senate bill yesterday. It, among other things, estimates that the number of people without health insurance would increase by 22 million by the year 2026 under this bill. What's your reaction?
So 22 million is pretty comparable to the CBO's estimate for the number of people that would have lost health insurance under the House bill, right? So the reality is there's not much that's really changed in the basic architecture of this legislation compared to what happened in the House. And that's really interesting because one of the things that we heard from a number of senators when the Senate began taking up the legislation in May was that they were going to kind of scrap what the House did and start with a completely new template. And what's really interesting is that the major parts of the law that kind of led to the score that the CBO gave it really haven't changed from the House's version. So a couple big elements are still there. Tax credits change in a way that's really similar to the House bill, so people are paying a lot more in premiums if you're especially if you're older or sicker. Additionally, a lot of the big tax cuts for health insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, actually the tanning bed industry, and other kinds of taxes on sort of higher income earners are all still there. As additionally, and probably the most important piece of the bill that's still there, is a gigantic cut to Medicaid. Now, Medicaid is a program that's existed since the 1960s, traditionally, it's covered elderly individuals, the disabled, and over the years, it's included coverage for mothers. It covers about 50% of live births in the United States, as well as children. And the interesting thing about both the House and the Senate bills is that while the CBO score really only looks at the effects of coverage on kind of the Affordable Care Act population, and there's a lot of coverage reduction because the bill cuts back on the expansion of Medicaid that the Affordable Care Act did. The bill really goes far beyond repealing Obamacare, but actually makes a huge change that really has not been on the agenda at all, and we've really not talked about, but it makes a huge change to the way that Medicaid works. And in particular, what it does is it caps funding to states for Medicaid. So that means you have a lot less funding, and states are going to basically either have to raise taxes or cut eligibility for people who, long before the Affordable Care Act came around, qualified. So elderly people, disabled people, and so forth.
Yeah. Well, and we'll get into more as we go along, but where, from what you've seen, where is the public on this health care issue? It seems that a lot of people didn't like Obamacare, but now it seems a lot of people don't like the plans to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting is, you know, when Obamacare was being considered, it was a pretty divisive law, right? You know, Democrats pretty strongly favored it. Republicans pretty strongly opposed it. So it's basically split along partisan lines. This piece of legislation is actually less popular, right? Only about 29% of people favor it, sort of nationwide, and actually in Wisconsin, the number is about the same. But you know, I would make a distinction, I guess, which is that you know, the reasons that this law is unpopular, oddly enough, are pretty similar to the reasons that Obamacare was unpopular. Beyond partisanship, right, which you know can make anything unpopular with a member of a particular party. You know, the most important unpopular element of Obamacare was that, you know, it didn't do some things that voters just kind of wanted, and voters just kind of think that health insurance is too expensive, right? It's one of those goods that we don't like to pay for, maybe because we don't think we should have to. And so it's not surprising that when you survey voters like about what they don't like about the ACA, most people say that, you know, premiums, right, what you pay annually or every month to your insurance company, they don't like that. They think those are too high. And the out-of-pocket spending, right, your deductibles, your copays, they think those are too high. So the interesting thing is that Republicans had this opportunity right now to do something that would pretty clearly make coverage more affordable and accessible. But the way that they've chosen to write the legislation hasn't really fundamentally reversed some of the things that were really unpopular about Obamacare. And so it's this really puzzling thing where, you know, you had this bill that was pretty unpopular. Republicans pretty successfully campaigned year after year to reverse some of the aspects of it that were least popular. And now the bill that they wrote doesn't really do a lot of those things to kind of make it more popular. So it's one of the somebody who studies reforms like this over a long period of time. It is one of the strangest kind of patterns of legislating that I've ever seen.
So what are they thinking?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, and I think you know one. I think problem with thinking about this is that we've been thinking about it as a health reform or as some kind of alternative to the Affordable Care Act. But that's not necessarily exactly what, you know, Republicans or factions within the Republican Party were concerned with, right? The idea of repealing and replacing the ACA is a pretty vague idea, right? It's entirely possible that what Republicans could have done when they took office in January was to say, okay, we're going to take the parts of the ACA that are kind of the least favorable, like the individual mandate, the requirement that you buy coverage. We're just going to eliminate those, and you know, tweak some things around the edges. Maybe give states a little bit more flexibility, and we'll call it a day. But there were some factions within the Republican Party that had different idea about what this legislation was a vehicle to do. So, for instance, you had groups like Americans for Prosperity, the sort of group backed by the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch. And what they were really interested in was tax cuts for small businesses, for business owners, and so forth. And so that became really, really paramount to what they wanted to see in the legislation. At the same time, you know, you had House Speaker Paul Ryan, and his real animating force in his life, in his political life, has been reforming entitlement programs like Medicaid and Medicare. And so when he came to the table, he looked at the ACA, and he didn't see, you know, repealing and replacing Obamacare per se as the goal. He saw changing Medicaid itself as the goal, and really doing something that Republicans had never been able to do before. And so, you know, in one sense, I think what Republicans were thinking about was not necessarily what voters wanted to see, but what these really, really powerful interest groups within the party cared about.
We will follow up on this after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the politics of health care. And we'll welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234 after this news. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a guest about the politics of health care, the health care bill that is currently before the U.S. Senate. Wondering if you think this is a good version of a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act or not. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Philip Rocco, an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He is the co-author of the 2016 book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. And he also authored an op-ed piece that was in the Madison Cap-Times yesterday. Will Congress listen to the Kochs or to the docs on health care? And we are we're answering that question during this hour, and again, welcoming your questions and your views. We have Gary on Facebook who says, yes, as long as this removes the mandatory compliance provision for Obamacare, it is a step in the right direction. Don't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. Just vote for it. He was telling Senator Johnson to just vote for it. What's your reaction to that, Professor Rocco?
Yeah, I think Gary is pretty representative of the way that people feel about the individual mandate. I think since the ACA was passed, the individual mandate, a requirement that you, if you, your employer doesn't provide health insurance and, you know, you don't have it through some other means, that you have to buy it on the individual market, I think that's long been the most unpopular part of the law. So even as other parts of the law have become popular, things like prohibition on insurers excluding you from coverage because of pre-existing condition, even as those parts of the law became very popular, the individual mandate was kind of like the very ugly blemish, the pimple on the Affordable Care Act. And it's been a really effective, I think, way for Republicans to rail against the law. I think the challenge that on the policy side that happens when you take away something like the individual mandate is that it becomes difficult to stabilize insurance markets because what happens is if you don't have healthy people buying coverage in a marketplace, the premiums in that marketplace go up. And so, you know, we have examples of this from the 1990s when states tried to create programs for health insurance for people who were traditionally kind of excluded from coverage. And, you know, what happened we saw pretty quickly was that in those markets, because you didn't have healthy people also buying coverage, there was no real incentive to do so. People only bought it when they became ill. And as a result, it became very prohibitively expensive for insurers to offer coverage, and so premiums became very high. And so it's one of these kind of conundrums that even if you don't have the individual mandate, as we see in the Senate bill, probably what's going to happen with this bill is that Republicans are going to have to create some other kind of penalty that incentivizes people to buy insurance to keep premiums down. And so I think the penalty that's been discussed is a provision that if you don't maintain continuous coverage in the insurance market, you'll be locked out of coverage. So if you miss a payment or something like that, or you fall off coverage, you'll be locked out of coverage for 6 months. So even if you get sick, you'll have to pay all of those fees out of pocket. And, you know, it's, I think it's worth highlighting that that's also not especially popular. Things where you're, forcing people to do something are not popular, but also aspects of policy where you are sort of seemingly arbitrarily taking things away from people at a moment when they need it are also not popular. So when it comes to using a market as a way of financing health insurance or delivering health insurance, unless you have some mechanism to keep people in, it's hard to do a lot of the other things that we like offering coverage to people regardless of their pre-existing conditions and so forth. But Gary is certainly, I think, in the majority that in public opinion that people don't like the individual mandate.
Let's go to Shelley in Waterford. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, no, I don't support the Republican bills. I haven't had a chance to read the Senate bill, but I read the House bill, and that one sucked, so I imagine this one will too, and in the details. One thing I would like to comment also on is that you had several experts that have said that these plans wouldn't affect people who have insurance through work, but they do. The ACA did, provided me with better coverage than I had, even though I have health insurance through work. The fact is these bills kind of put the law of the land down, and it affects all insurance for all Americans. And I just disagree completely with Mr. Johnson's attitude towards my life, that it's just a commodity to be bought on the free market, and that's why he's against this bill, because he wants my life to be bought and sold as a commodity. But I do agree with him in his disagreement of the bill.
Thank you, Shelley. Let's talk a little bit, Professor Rocco, prompted by Shelley. Why does Senator Johnson oppose the GOP Senate version of this bill?
That's a great question. And I think that there's sort of his stated reason for opposing it. And then I think there's a sort of political reality around whether or not you should support a law that has 29% popularity kind of in the electorate. So yesterday, Senator Johnson issued an op-ed in the New York Times in which he argued that he was against the bill. He had thought that Republicans kind of the leadership ran it through, didn't really give him time to look at or analyze the bill. So he was kind of arguing that the process was wrong. But then he also, I think, went a little bit further to make some kind of conservative bona fides on the legislation and basically argued that the leadership in the Senate hadn't dealt seriously with the idea that, banning insurers from denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, he argued, drives up the cost of insurance for everyone. That's a quote from him. And I actually thought that was pretty surprising. I've been closely monitoring senators' positions on this bill, and Johnson really was not on my radar as somebody that I thought would, ultimately kind of defect from what the leadership was saying, and B, would take this kind of position, right? Because I think that while things like the individual mandate aren't popular, one of the most broadly popular things that the ACA does is protect people with pre-existing conditions. And to get to Shelley's point, I think that it protects people not just in the individual marketplace, but it also does things like ban lifetime and annual limits, and that applies far beyond the individual marketplace. And so I think that Johnson is trying to thread a needle here, right? On the one hand, you have a pretty unpopular piece of legislation pretty broadly because of things like that. But on the other hand, you have the possibility that if you come out, as Senator Dean Heller did, and oppose the legislation on the grounds that it is, in a sense, not generous enough, or the legislation is too mean to use President Trump's words, you know, conservative groups will put a primary challenger, against you in 2020 or whenever you're up for re-election. And so it's a really difficult needle to thread because on the one hand, you know, Senator Johnson, you know, didn't necessarily it's not like he won counties only that weren't affected by the ACA. There were a lot of beneficiaries in the counties that he won that were. But at the same time, you know, he does have this conservative base that he has to appeal to. And so it's hard to say the real reason why I think he opposes the legislation. I think that there are multiple reasons why.
Funny, Charles on Facebook says, I hope Johnson votes yes. To be clear, this is a terrible plan, hastily cobbled together in total secrecy, but insofar as elections have legislative consequences, wouldn't it be an interesting experiment to find out if legislation will have electoral consequences next year? If we get out of the way and let the Republican Party do this to the American people and there is no one else to blame, why wouldn't that be a natural consequence for the low-information voters who have brought us into this situation or brought this onto themselves? Well, so there's more on the politics of this health care, I guess. What would be the legislative consequences?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the challenge, you know, I think it's hard for me to use historical kind of precedent to say that Republicans would just sort of avoid punishment for enacting this piece of legislation. It's pretty unpopular. There's no sort of magic formula for making an unpopular piece of legislation popular after it's enacted, unless you radically undermine the things that you did to make it unpopular in the first place. And if you look at something like Obamacare, right, it was a partisan piece of legislation. It was divisive. And in the 2010 midterm elections, Democrats paid for it. And there's been a number of studies that have suggested that, the sort of backlash to Obamacare was, you know, one reason why Democrats suffered as badly as they did. But I would say that, you know, with something like this law, I think that, you know, it's important to remember voters don't only vote based on their policy preferences. They often vote based on their partisan identification and how strongly they feel about the party. And the Republican Party, in designing this legislation, has done a few things to kind of insulate themselves against electoral risks. And one thing that they've done is that they've pushed off some of the worst consequences, the most unpopular consequences of the law, to, you know, 2020. Right. So many of the provisions of the law don't kind of kick in immediately. And I think that that's one attempt to kind of insulate themselves from risk. And the other thing that I think has been really remarkable is that whatever the consequences of the legislation, whatever its contents, and whatever its the analysis that comes out of the Congressional Budget Office, Republicans have just kind of remained committed to this idea that this legislation will reduce everybody's premiums, more people will be covered, nobody's going to lose their coverage, and so forth, which are electoral promises, but at the same time, they don't match at all what's in the bill. And so I think the real important thing to look at is, you know, do people, if this passes, do people still continue to believe, even against the, you know, reality of what's going on, that this is making, you know, healthcare better for most people or even better for themselves? And, you know, that might happen. And I think that if the law passes, what you really want to look at is, A, how do voters' beliefs about what's going on change? And B, you know, what are interest groups doing to inform voters about how the legislation affects them? Right? So voters, you know, and this is, you know, no knock to voters, but people don't have a lot of time to read legislation or participate in politics, although one of the callers before had read the bill, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. But most of the way that people learn about what's going on is through groups like, you know, the AARP or the American Medical Association or other kind of trusted organizations in society that kind of say, all right, here's the plain English version of this, you know, legal mumbo jumbo. And, you know, here's what it means. And I think that if those organizations kind of get out there and inform people about what's going on, what's in the legislation, if it passes, that could really mean very bad things for Republicans in 2018.
Well, Senate leadership is pushing for a vote on this by the end of the week. It would not be apparently the vote to repeal and replace, but a procedural vote to push this forward. Ron Johnson was on Meet the Press on Sunday, and here's a clip of moderator Chuck Todd pressing Johnson for his position on this vote.
I would like to delay the thing. There's no way we should be voting on this next week. No way. There's
Are
no way.
Are you going to work to stop
folks
it?
In Wisconsin,
Are you going to work to stop a vote next week?
I have a hard time believing Wisconsin constituents or even myself will have enough time to properly evaluate this for me to vote for a motion to proceed. So I've been encouraging leadership, the White House, anybody I can talk to for quite some time. Let's not rush this process.
So what are your thoughts on this motion to proceed?
Well, I think that, you know, I have kind of tried to read, statements by senators somewhat conservatively about what they might mean. But I think whatever the ultimate vote on the legislation is, right, whether or not people support repealing or replacing, I think that it's hard to see how Mitch McConnell gets to 50 votes on a motion to proceed. I think that, you know, if you look at Senate moderates like Dean Heller from Nevada, Susan Collins from Maine, they seem pretty committed to voting no on a motion to proceed. They want time to, you know, really reevaluate the legislation. And, you know, you even had Susan Collins yesterday saying that you know, this bill doesn't do what Republicans have promised to do, and that she wants to work, you know, across the aisle with Democrats in order to kind of reboot the legislation. At the same time, you have conservatives like Rand Paul of Kentucky, Mike Lee of Utah, and they've kind of taken an even harder line than Senator Johnson on, you know, the bill not being conservative enough, and, you know, here are the four or five things we would need in order to vote for it. And then Johnson kind of makes up a faction sort of in between, where I think, you know, he's really most of what he's charged as being the problem with the legislation is the process, right? And that's kind of slicing the salami pretty thinly to not sort of anger either part of the constituency. So I think that it's going to be really hard to see a vote on a motion to proceed this week.
Philip Rocco is our guest, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. His research, among other things, looks at the politics of health reform. He is also the co-author of the book, Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. And we are talking about the GOP health care bill that is in the Senate right now. And welcoming your questions and views on this at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We're talking the politics of health care during this hour. I'm Joy Cardine with Philip Rocco, an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He is the co-author of the 2016 book, Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act, with us to talk about the GOP health care plans and the version that's currently in the U.S. Senate, set to be voted on later this week, or at least a motion to proceed is is in the works, but it's controversial. Not everyone supports the Senate version, including Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. So do you support this version or not? Why or why not? Do you have questions about what's in it or thoughts about the replacement of the Affordable Care Act? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll get back to calls in just a moment, but I did want to play a recent clip from a Fox and Friends interview, President Trump expressing optimism that the Senate could strike a deal this week on health care. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
Health care is a very, very tough thing to get, but I think we're going to get it. We don't have too much of a choice because the alternative is the dead carcass of Obamacare. That's what it is.
So, Professor Rocco, first off, what about President Trump's claim that the Affordable Care Act is a dead carcass?
Well, I mean, that's fairly colorful language, I guess, not entirely surprising for President Trump. But I think that when you look at analyses of health insurance markets currently, you know, there's, for the most part, stability in health insurance markets across the country. And then, of course, a huge part of the ACA was the expansion of Medicaid. And in, you know, around half or a little bit more than half of the states, you know, that has occurred. And you know, from everything that we can tell, there's no major implementation problems with that. And more people are getting health insurance coverage. And so the idea that there's a kind of problems with the Affordable Care Act, I think, is certainly true. And I think it's actually most true for a kind of rural constituencies, people that, you know, largely voted for President Trump. In rural areas, it is expensive to provide health insurance coverage. The costs of, you know, getting goods to market is high, and there's not a lot of competition. Insurers don't necessarily want to cover very few people, and in many cases, these are populations that have chronic diseases, and they're expensive to cover. So it's not that there are, you know, everything is great everywhere for everyone. That's simply not true. But I think the interesting thing is how little this law seems to do, at least from reading it and looking at the analyses of it, to really solve those problems that rural areas face. In fact, it seems like in many cases, especially if you're older, it would make those problems worse. And so it's kind of like the problems that I think Trump might be referring to elliptically, you know, you could solve with a scalpel, but this is a giant mallet. It doesn't really, it's not really clear, you know, that what needs to be fixed in the Affordable Care Act is what this legislation does.
Next, we go to Dave in Caledonia. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. The way I understand it, the Affordable Care Act was based on Mitt Romney, the Republican Massachusetts governor's program. And actually, it's very much more conservative than what he had in that state. And of course, it was watered down before it actually passed through Congress. Now, the Republicans have stereotyped this as Obamacare, and they just have to kind of live with that. I think they may live with that forever. That's a big mistake. But what it does is create competition at the state level for insurance. That seems like a very Republican idea, but yet they're all against it. Now, I think, why would they be against this? Now, since World War II, we did not have any socialized healthcare system like most of the Western world. We had the free market, and a lot of companies are not offering their employees insurance anymore. So therefore, I think we have regional monopolies, if the way I understand it. And they must be manipulating the Republicans into doing this Obamacare, anti-Obamacare thing.
Let me jump in because, Dave, I appreciate, but we have lots going on still. Professor Rocco, who's pushing the Republicans to repeal what was at one time a Republican plan in the state of Massachusetts?
Yeah, Dave makes a really good point that this is, in fact, you know, a plan borrowed by Democrats from Republicans. And I think that, so then the question is, right, that seemed, I think, to Democrats at the time, like it would make it a kind of sacred program that nobody could oppose. And I think that the major opposition I've seen in my research to the Affordable Care Act is from, on the one hand, small businesses. So the National Federation of Independent Business was kind of like the organization that put the first Supreme Court challenge to the Affordable Care Act. So a lot of opposition to small businesses, basically because small businesses had, as a sector, kind of grown, but they really hadn't had any kind of requirements or any incentive to provide insurance to their employees. And now this essentially either, you know, require them to do so or tax them in order to pay for some of these coverage provisions. And so that was pretty unpopular with small business. It was also really unpopular with a kind of, you know, ideological conservative organizations like Americans for Prosperity or Freedom Works that really, you know, have a pretty clear vision that not only should, you know, we not be doing things like Medicare or sort of public anything like single payer, but also, you know, subsidies from the federal government for people to buy insurance and regulatory protections to prevent people from, you know, being denied coverage were simply kind of not within their ideological worldview. And but beyond that, there's not really a lot of support for this particular piece of legislation. Doctors oppose it. Hospitals oppose it. Insurance companies are somewhat divided on it, I think. And the health insurance industry is, you know, I think generally going to lose from this piece of legislation. But I think that there are some kind of actors in the industry that are kind of trying to see what could be, what could be possible, what kind of deals they could work from it. You know, in general, I think the main opposition has been kind of business organizations and ideological conservatives.
Dia in Burlington is with us. Hi, Dia.
Hi. My question may be broad. I don't understand why we talk about premium costs rather than health care costs. Don't premium costs and insurance costs follow what health care costs?
Professor Rocco?
Yeah, I think that it's a good point, right? This law is very confusing, I think, for most people to understand, right? And I think one of the things that makes it hard to understand is that, you know, when the Congressional Budget Office comes out with a score or analysis of the law, you know, it talks about premium costs, and that's been a real focus for Republicans in selling the legislation is, you know, they say, well, the CBO shows that on average, you know, premium costs go down by, you know, 20% by 2026, right? That's their kind of top-line selling point. And that's true, although depending on who you are, premium costs will go up, right, especially if you're older or you are sicker or something like that. But the in reality, premiums are not only what you pay for insurance. Everybody knows that there are premiums, but there's also co-insurance, co-pays, deductibles, these things that you're paying out of pocket for your care. And one thing that this law does is that it lowers what's called the actuarial value for most plans that are sold on the individual market. And so what that means is that insurers will be on the hook for less of your overall health care costs, which means that, you know, even if your premiums go down, you're still going to be paying, you know, a pretty large amount of your coverage at, you know, either at the pharmacy counter or at the doctor's office or something like that. Now, you know, if you are, you know, young and healthy maybe, or if you just imagine that you will never get sick ever, that's probably fine. But in reality, when you do get sick, it can be a huge sticker shock, and people don't, you know, unsurprisingly, people don't like that.
Let's go to Jan in Green Bay.
Hi. Speaking of sticker shock, what happened to that $2,500 a year promise? What happened to the you can keep your doctor? The whole thing was sold by Nancy Pelosi on an overnight basis. Now they're saying that it's too secret, but it's been out there for days. And I want to know what the professor would, how he would interpret the 10th Amendment.
Well, I don't know about the 10th Amendment, Jan, but Jan told my producer that he wanted Obamacare to be repealed and never mind replacing it. What about that, Professor Rocco?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, Jan is right in the sense that there were provisions in the law that, you know, Democrats sort of promised and probably overpromised on. I think that something like promising people that they could keep insurance if they liked it wasn't entirely correct, of course, right? One of the things that the ACA did was that it said that certain kinds of insurance plans, especially ones that didn't really cover most of your major medical costs, right? Things that were just, yes, it was an insurance plan. Yes, you could buy it. Yes, the premiums might be low. But when you got to the doctor, you were paying, you know, something like 80 or 85% of your major medical costs, right? What the ACA did was basically say, that's not insurance, right? Because most of what you are ultimately paying, you're paying yourself, and the insurance isn't covering it.
We have just 30 seconds to go, unfortunately. So I might have to really abbreviate you. What are you watching for this week?
Well, this week what I'm watching for is really hard promises from Senate Republicans that they it's not just that they, you know, might vote for it or might not vote for a motion to proceed, but that they, you know, can kind of credibly say, you know, we don't want to go forward on this. And I think that a statement like Susan Collins made yesterday, something like, you know, this piece of legislation is not something I want to go forward with. I want to take a different path. And even I think Ron Johnson's op-ed was one of the strongest statements kind of against moving forward with the law that I've seen yet. That's really what I'm looking for. I think that the question this week is whether or not the Senate, you know, proceeds to vote more quickly on the legislation. I think that longer term.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I have to leave it there. Thanks very much for being with us. Philip Rocco is with Marquette University.